Well, if you're from Wisconsin, you have no doubt heard the term, it's not the heat, it's the humidity. Larry Mueller here. The weather guys are back to talk about tropical storms, so heat, humidity, and a whole lot more. With me in the studio, John Martin. John's professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. John, good to have you back.
Good to be back, Larry.
With us by phone today, Steve Ackerman, Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences as well. And as Bassam Shakashiri just mentioned, Steve is retiring, I think, on September 15th.
The 15th.
Is that right, Steve?
That is absolutely right, although I am not retiring from being one of the weather guys.
We made sure of that before anything else happened. I wanted to know that you were still going to keep in that role, and it's good to have you with us, even if it's by phone. Where are you?
I am in Walla Walla, Washington, where it is going to hit 101 degrees today. So
yeah,
we're getting the hot weather as well.
Oh, man. Yeah. Well, we'll talk about that hot weather. You had a fun column about, kind of interesting, about whether birds get struck by lightning. I wanted to get that question answered as well. And as we talk with Steve and John, I hope you'll join in with your own questions and comments. What's the weather like where you are? Are you loving or hating it, the humidity? Not today.
Beautiful outside today.
Beautiful today. Anyway, tell us your feelings, your questions. Join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Let's get that bird question out of the way. You two answered this in a recent column. Do birds get struck by lightning?
I don't remember that column. They roost in trees, so okay, there's one place where they can definitely meet their maker. I don't know about the other. Steve, you must have written that, because I have no recollection of that at all.
Yeah, and that came from somebody sent me a photo of a bunch of birds dead at the base of a tree. And it was right after, it was like the second week in August, so right after a thunderstorm.
Mm.
And what I think it's due to is, you know, we learn at a young age you shouldn't stand under a tree during a thunderstorm because the tree could get hit. The energy from the lightning bolt traveled down the branches, the trunk, and into the roots. And then that's where we could get a shock.
Mm.
And I think what happened in this case is that the tree got struck and the birds were seeking shelter from the storm by roosting in the tree.
Yeah,
and they all got basically electrocuted.
Yeah.
But they're not going to get struck while they're flying in the air, or I suppose it's likely, maybe? No.
I don't see anything that would protect them from that eventuality, but it's probably so rare that it just almost, you know, they're a little pinprick in a giant maelstrom. And they're probably not flying in a thunderstorm either. They know what to do.
Steve, are you agreeing with John?
I would agree. I think the probability would be so small. And then also, as John says, you know, they're generally seek shelter in a thunderstorm. They're not going to be flying around. So low probability of getting hit, but possible.
All right. Low probability of getting hit, but it's possible. Steve Ackerman and John Martin are our guests today, and we certainly would love to have you join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Janet in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I looked at my weather app a couple of hours ago, and it said that it was going to be 109 a week from Wednesday. And I thought, oh, that can't be right. So I looked at a different weather app, and it said it was going to be 110. Then within the hour later, I looked again, and it was back down to 93. So I have two questions. What goes on with these weather apps, and where do they get their statistics? And is it really going to be in the middle 90s next week in September, and why?
Okay, there's a couple of questions there. I think I have noticed the same thing for the first time this summer. that in the long range, and looking to next Wednesday is pretty much in the long range, 9 days from now, on various weather apps, including the one that's on the iPhone, and there's probably others on other devices, they do seem to have mixed in some really crazy 9-ish, 10-day-ish forecasts occasionally this summer, and I'm not really sure what that's all about. Now, one thing that they probably, and I'm only guessing, they draw that information from output that comes from National Meteorological Center models. One of them is called the Global Forecast System, the GFS model, that goes out that far and makes forecasts for localities. Now, that's routinely going to have some recalibration that's done by the time you go from the 9- and 10-day range to the 3- and 4-day range. So that might account for some of the relaxation back to what sounds a little normal, 93. So that's the first part of the question. I know there's not really a lot of answer there, but it's all speculation because I've encountered the same thing. Now, the second part of the question, the first week of September is routinely a very warm week. In fact, there was one summer, I think it was the summer of 2000, we hadn't had a day over 90 until September 2nd. And I was away. I was in California at the time, so I was really kind of disappointed. I missed the only 90-degree Fahrenheit day of the whole summer. But that's not at all uncommon. We can stay that warm all the way to the equinox with a fair degree of confidence. I hope that it's not like that because I start to wear a tie and a jacket to class starting September 7th. I don't want to be sweating to death, but it happens every year. So,
Steve, anything to add to that?
Yeah, no, I think John is right for two aspects, or I agree with. One is, the long-range forecast where we're talking, a week, 10 days, is getting better. But there's still a lot of error associated with it. But it's important that we keep trying and make the models better. And I think that's why apps are beginning to pick it up and display it, because we're interested in it. And I am tired of this hot weather. I want to get the fall weather, nice, cool fall weather with colorful trees.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we've got the nice, it feels really cool, the Madison area, at least, I think across a good part of the state.
Yeah, low dew points, temperatures in the high 50s in the morning and getting to maybe 80 in the afternoon, that's perfect. Well, the best month of the year is coming up, as we all know. September 15th to October 15th is the best 130-day period of the entire year in terms of weather around here, and it's coming.
It's coming. Yeah. Well, couple of storms came. Two tropical storms made national headlines last week. Hurricane Hillary hit Southern California. Tropical Storm Harold took place in Texas. I watched a NOVA, I think it was NOVA, a couple nights ago about hurricanes and the weather. And I thought they did a really nice job of explaining, but how do these storms form?
They tend to form, first of all, I should say this, and this is a theory from a colleague of mine, Greg Tripoli, who's now retired, because I'm not an expert in tropical cyclones, and we have a lot of people in the department who are. But his thesis, he was one of those experts, his thesis was the tropics are hostile to the development of these storms. That's why there are so few of them every year. So there's something about the tropical environment that discourages their development. So every once in a while, whatever it is in the environment, it's usually vertical wind shear or some other characteristic like that. And that just means wind speeds of different magnitudes at different heights in the atmosphere. The tropics, when they relent a little bit and the wind shear dies down and or the collection of thunderstorms can get themselves better organized, that's when you can start to develop a tropical cyclone. So they're relatively rare as storms go. But not so rare as to present very limited threat. They present a substantial threat. And they're a little bit more numerous in the Pacific Basin off the coast of Mexico than they are in the Atlantic Basin during the summertime in the early fall. So they are effectively collections of thunderstorms that become self-sustaining and get larger and larger in scale. But even the largest scale hurricane is very much smaller in scale, and it's the extent of the damaging winds and heavy rains is usually a lot smaller than the kind of storms we have here in the middle latitudes. So although the storms in the tropics are more powerful, but they don't encompass quite as large an area. So they're very different beasts entirely than the ones that we're used to here in the Midwest at the Great Lakes latitude.
Yeah.
But they're beastly storms.
Steve, you want to chime in?
No, I agree with John. The thing is, while they're rare, they come at the same time of the year all the time. And so they seem common, but they're not.
Mm.
Vern says he thinks he's proven or mathematically that global warming isn't caused by humans. though he says it's classified information. But he says it's definitely made worse by airplane travel. Would like Steve and John to prove that climate change is caused by humans.
Well, you're asking two people in a span of 2 seconds to prove something that scientists have wrestled with for 100 years and have organized themselves into international communities to make statements about. I don't think we really can do that any better than they can. But there's absolutely no question that human beings have been the cause of the warming in the last 150 years, 200 years. There's no question at all about that. If anybody who's interested in this issue broadly would like to contribute to what we do next, I would suggest that that contribution is going to be best made by looking for solutions to our next 25 years, our next 50 years, and not hopping on whether or not we've proven that human beings have been behind what's happened in the last 150 years. That's beyond any doubt, not even reasonable doubt, any doubt.
Yeah.
So,
Steve, comment?
Yeah, no, I agree 100% with what John said. I mean, the physics is there that would cause warming based on our activities. And as John says, there are hundreds and hundreds of papers out there now that have been peer-reviewed over decades that have now demonstrated that, yeah, it's occurring and we're the cause of it.
And if I could, I would say this about peer review. And when you're not in the trenches as a working scientist, you might not know what that means. And, of course, that's perfectly reasonable. But peer review means that you submit your paper, your ideas, and your theory and your evidence for your idea to a series of anonymous reviewers who are in the field. And those reviewers are not very happy that you've come up with a cool idea that they didn't come up with. Let's be honest. They're not. They'd rather have come up with it themselves. And so there's an enormous amount of skepticism about accepting your idea from anybody else in the community. And that skepticism can only be eroded by defending the statements you make beyond any doubt. And so it's hard to get through the peer review process. And without knowing that, that can sound like a flippant little thing that we throw in there to cover ourselves. But it's a serious, serious gauntlet that has to be passed. And for thousands of papers to have done that on the same score means that they're right.
Our guests today, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, are weather guys, and they're going to be with us right up until 12:30 today as we talk climate and weather with them, and I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back right after this look at the news. I'm Larry Mueller. We're taking a look at climate and weather with our weather guys today. John Martin, professor, former, I'm sorry, he's not a former, well, I guess he's a former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve Ackerman with us as well, Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW-Madison. And they come by the last Monday of every month to talk climate and weather. So I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments as we move along. How much rain's your area received? Have you seen lightning strikes? We were just talking about that a few minutes back. Have you had one strike a tree or your house? Share your general questions at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Nathaniel emailed us just relating about global warming and if it's caused by humans. He would like to point out that last year, humans burned over 8 billion tons of coal in 1 year. If the human-run economy has put that much carbon in the air in just that amount of time, then perhaps it should be expected that humans are having an impact.
Well, you know that when I started college in 1982, the carbon dioxide fraction in the atmosphere was already above what it had been in the last 800,000 years. It was at 320-ish parts per million. It has risen continuously in the intervening 40 years to now well over 415 parts per million, which is way above, 120 or so parts per million above all the reconstructions from global ice cores that can be made back a couple of million years. So we're in uncharted territory in terms of how much carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere. And the carbon dioxide is a radiative, it has a radiative blanket effect on the planet, warms it up. And so if you really want to look at the smoking gun, that's it. And where does that carbon dioxide come from? Human industrialization. You know, it's the global oil companies don't make guesses about how much petroleum they've taken out of the earth, how much they've sold, how much they've put in the strategic petroleum reserves around the world. They know exactly how much has been used, and that amount coincides exactly with what's happened since we've been using petroleum products in terms of increasing the carbon dioxide fraction. And I'll add one last thing for our prior caller. We run no risk of losing our oxygen, molecular oxygen reservoir. 22% of every breath you take is molecular oxygen, O2. However, when you burn carbon fuels, you use a little bit of that to be involved in the fire. And in fact, the amount of oxygen that's gone down is in precise proportion to the amount of carbon that's been added. So this is a hand-to-glove fit. There's so many different ways to approach this, and none of them refute the others. So we're in it.
Chris wondered what role the cycles of the sun could play in terms of weather and climate.
Yeah, Steve knows a lot about that radiation measurement. He might have some more particular insights than I would.
Yeah, the sun has a 22-year cycle. We often think of it as because of the sunspots on the sun, and so its temperature changes a little bit. But in the time frame that we're talking about here with regard to human impact, the variations in the solar output really aren't causing the types of warmings that we're seeing. We'd have to look over millions of years and how the output of the sun changed over that time period. And I think it's an interesting number that John pointed out. In less than 50 years, we went from 320 parts per million to 415. That's almost an increase of 100 parts per million.
Yeah, 33%.
In that short period of time. That's amazing.
It is. It's stunning, and it's irrefutable evidence that there's an engine behind this change, and it's not just natural variability that we somehow unluckily got ourselves caught in. That's absolute nonsense.
Let's talk about humidity for a minute. Last time you were on, we talked about heat waves, but we didn't talk much about humidity, which I'm sure many people experienced last week.
Yeah, I suspect they did.
What does it mean if weather conditions are humid?
That means there's every day there's a little bit of water vapor in the atmosphere. That's invisible water gas. You can't see it, just like you can't see oxygen, nitrogen, or any of the other gases. But that variable amount, is highly variable and dependent on weather conditions. So once in a while, you get spikes of enormous extent, like we had last week, of how much water vapor is actually in the atmosphere. And we had a dew point at 7 p.m. on Thursday, I think, last week, of 81, maybe it was Wednesday, of 81 degrees Fahrenheit. That's as high as it's ever been. It reached the same high level that I'd seen one other time since I've been here in 30 years. So that's an extremely high dew point, testifying to a huge amount of water vapor in the atmosphere. And the reason that makes you uncomfortable is that your body has a natural ability to cool itself off when the air temperature surrounding it is high, and that is perspiration, because your body temperature wants to stay around 98.6 or whatever it is for you. It might be a little bit plus or minus that. And the way it does it is your body secretes water from your sweat glands onto your skin. That water is not cooler than your body's temperature. It's exactly the same temperature. It's not like dipping in a cold pool. So the way that that perspiration cools you is by evaporating into the air, and the energy comes from your skin to do the evaporation of the liquid water. If there's no room in the air for any more water vapor, you can't evaporate it no matter how much energy your skin provides, and you risk hypothermia in that case. And so the higher the humidity, the hotter it is to perspire and cool off. That's why it's uncomfortable.
And Mark in Sussex has a question about dew points. So let's just go there. Mark, hi. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I look at the national weather charts occasionally, and I was wondering with all that heat down south what their dew points were. And I looked somewhere in Mississippi. You can click on the national weather, and it'll have a three-day history. They actually had a negative dew point. I don't understand that.
I'm surprised it would be in Mississippi, but it's routinely in the desert. So places like Death Valley can have a dew point of minus 5. And what that means is that you got to cool the air that to that extremely low temperature before you're ever going to see any of the water. In that case, it's not going to condense. It's going to freeze. But you're going to get it to change phase from vapor to some other phase of the water substance. So that's testifying to extraordinarily dry air when you have dew points that are below 0 Fahrenheit. They're not common, and probably not happening in Mississippi. It might have been somewhere else, but or it was an error. That's possible, too, in the reporting. So... yeah, but it can happen. You can have dew points below zero.
Yeah, go ahead, Steve.
No, I was just laughing at that, too, because I think, yeah, seeing that in the South would be hard unless either a misreport or maybe there was an instrument failure and that was the default report for a particular type of instrument failure.
So why, you know, this dry heat business, why is the Midwest so humid compared to the West?
Yeah, a couple of good reasons for that. One of them is 100% natural. We are not that far from the Gulf of Mexico. And when we have the conditions that will pump the temperature up through a process called advection, which means simply horizontally moving air from a warmer spot towards you, that warmer spot is almost always south of us. So as we get warmer, we have winds from the south, and those same winds will carry higher water vapor content air towards us as well. Mm-hmm. So you usually get both of them at the same time. In the desert southwest, you're not as, you know, you've got the Mexican plateau and other parts of the Rocky Mountain chain that intercept any water that might come off, water vapor that might come off the eastern Pacific. It'll never get across into Arizona, in New Mexico, except for a short period of time in late August, where once in a while they can get a pretty high dew point. But it's very uncommon.
George in Oshkosh has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, George.
Hi, guys. Enjoying the show.
Hey.
I recently read a book called The Hurricane Code, which predicts, it's a climate fiction book, but I thought this was interesting. It predicts that there will be a mass migration of people from Texas and Oklahoma and places like that up to the upper Midwest, because the climate's going to get so extreme. Do you think there's anything to that?
I do. Yes, I do. I think that when you think about just this summer, all of the hot spots around the country, and no pun intended, but places where the summertime weather became the news, of all of those places, the one that probably made the list least frequently was the Western Great Lakes states until last week. And so, yeah, I think there's something to that.
Yeah,
and couple that with the fact that our notoriously frigid winters are probably becoming mild, or certainly are becoming milder. I think the threat that Texans or people from the South might fear about the wintertime here is disappearing. In fact, I think even the football recruiting here at Wisconsin, they try and get those guys from Florida and Texas. They used to just say, no, I'm not going to play up there. It snows in the last three games of the year. No, it doesn't anymore. And you can actually state that with confidence. So... they shouldn't be so scared.
Steve, comment?
I will say there are two things. One is I can imagine retirees moving further north. I think a general movement will also depend on what the economic capabilities are and whether or not folks have those opportunities. Because that's the other thing that really drives you out of to a new area. Is an economic opportunity.
Yeah.
But when you're retired, and you can tell I'm thinking about that, Madison's a great place to live, and I'm going to stay there.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the Midwest, I mean, Lake Superior's 10% of the fresh water supply in the world is in Lake Superior.
Isn't that amazing? It's amazing.
And if you add in the rest of the Great Lakes, it's 20% of the fresh water supply in the world is... wow, that's right in the Midwest.
Yeah, and the watershed around the Great Lakes is really small. So the water that comes off the lakes and then falls back as precipitation stays local. It's amazing.
Yeah. George, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Karen in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I wanted to know, maybe it was several years back when it was so cold here, in Madison, and I went outside in my sock feet to, you know, spread some food for the animals, and came in. It was below zero, and then I called the radio station weather person, and they said, instead, what are you doing out outside in your sock feet. Actually, my feet were totally dry, and I just am questioning if the dew point was so low that it was equivalent, like, to being dry ice out there, which is why I never got wet at all.
That's interesting. So there was snow on the ground, Karen, at the time, a little bit of snow?
Snow all over the ground.
Yeah, I mean, on the ground, yeah. I thought that's what I said, yeah. So, Steve's, we've talked about this a number of times just between the two of us because we're kind of interested in this. When you have snowflakes with really low temperatures, which almost always means also very low dew points, and you're right, your suspicion about the lack of water vapor is a good one, it makes the snow crystals act more as individual entities than as collections. So when you step on them, they crunch. Have you heard that? You know, when you have a shoe on a really cold day, the snow crunches a lot more. And it's because you're cracking crystals. There's no intermediate liquid phase where you melt them by putting higher pressure on them. You just crack them. And so I wonder if something like that is the reason why your socks maybe had a few snowflakes on them and they quickly disappeared off your feet when you got into the house, and they never melted next to your skin because it just was too cold and the dew point was so low.
And I tried to catch that.
I'm flashing back, and I don't know if it was the same year, but there was a time when it was really, really cold and really, really dry. And Ann and I boiled a pot of water and went outside on the back patio and threw it up into the air because it was so dry and so cold that all of that water just sublimed and either froze or evaporated before it hit the ground.
Oh, that's a famous experiment. I've never done it, but I'm glad to hear you did and it worked.
Yeah. It was the first time we had a chance to try that, and it was really a lot of fun.
That's awesome.
I don't know if it was the same times as scouring, but it was cold and it was dry.
So I'm going to suggest, Steve, that now that you're about to retire, what you want to join my crusade to have a really cold winter so you can have multiple such opportunities.
Karen, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Well, we got Elizabeth in Columbia County, so let's go there. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I just wanted to attest that I really think climate migration is here. I often go back to an experience we had vacationing up in Bayfield about 5 years ago. The innkeeper at that time said he'd had multiple contacts with people from Texas and California who were inquiring about land sales and, you know, what his business was like. And I also have a niece in Bozeman who can attest that there's been all kinds of people who've moved from the cities on the Pacific coast inland to their area. And it has lots of repercussions for all of us. So I think it's important and it's here.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, it's probably something, it's hopefully something that our planners are thinking about for down the road. Thanks, Elizabeth. Appreciate it very much. Question about trade winds. Mariners, centuries ago, searched for trade winds that would propel them, I guess, toward monetary success.
Yeah, usually westward, yeah.
What are trade winds and why do people want to find them?
The trade winds are part of a broader circulation that develops in the tropics and subtropics called the Hadley Circulation. And that's driven mostly by the presence of and the activity of thunderstorms at or near the equator. So in the northern hemisphere summer, like we're in now, it's a little bit north of the equator, the intertropical convergence zone where these thunderstorms tend most often to develop. And so the thunderstorms themselves represent a very strong and concerted updraft of air at about 0 degrees latitude. When the air gets to the tropopause, it has to spread out and sink at higher latitudes. And so the sinking goes on around 20 to 25 degrees north latitude. And when that air that's slowly sinking at that latitude hits the ground, it then heads southward toward the equator. The fact that the Earth is rotating turns those winds to be actually blowing from, instead of north to south, from east to west. And that's the trade winds. So it's at the base of the downward branch of the broader Hadley cell. And so if you are in Spain, like Columbus was, or Magellan, you want to go straight southward along the coast of Africa until you get to about 20 degrees south, and then you head east across the west across the Atlantic Ocean at those low latitudes. And mariners knew that.
The winds.
They knew that before they understood it. Yeah, they knew it was true.
How do people, are they studied? Are trade winds studied a lot today? How are they studied?
Yeah, they're studied. And in fact, there's sometimes they have everything to do with the migration of disturbances off of Africa, equatorial Africa, or the Saharan, southern boundary of the Sahara, that can turn into tropical cyclones in the Atlantic Basin. So they're known as African easterly waves because they come from Africa and they head from east to west. And so they're carried along in the trade winds. So they're a really important part of the global circulation, and especially the tropical developments that we get at this time of year.
I want to go back to humidity and heat and baseball for a minute.
Excellent.
I was watching a game, a few games ago, where the balls, it was warm, and the balls were flying further. What is it about... What conditions make for that? Because there were some home runs that probably wouldn't have been.
Yeah, like William Contreras hit one 450 feet yesterday afternoon, which was quite stunning. If the air temperature itself is warm, the air is less dense, and that means there's bigger spaces between molecules of gas in the atmosphere. That makes it easier for any object to move through the gas. If there's water vapor of a high content in that mixture, then the air is also less dense. It's lighter and lighter and lighter the more water vapor you add to it, because water vapor weighs less than the air does. And so if you mix more of it in there, you get a lighter air. It makes the ball carry a little further. The downside is it makes the players a lot more tired. So, there's a battle between those two that are going in opposite directions, but not in every case, so as you're pointing out.
Was Steve...
John, I'm wondering, you're a baseball fan. Has anybody looked at the statistics of home runs versus temperature and humidity?
It's a really good question. I think that one of the more recent additions to baseball records is the distance for home runs. I think that would be the thing to do, because you could almost normalize that. Oh. You could say, is on the days when the heat index or the, equivalent potential temperature is above 370, when home runs are hit, are they farther than they would be otherwise? You'd have to factor out winds and all the rest of that, but it would be really interesting and probably not that difficult to do. Now, what we have to do, Steve, is find a club that wants to know that information, and we can sell it to them. Until or unless, I won't do the work.
Well, maybe in your retirement, Steve.
Right, that's what I'm thinking.
Larry, you're right on. That's just what I'm trying to get him to think.
When you think back and look back at your time here at the university, what are some of your favorite memories, Steve?
Some of my favorite memories are working with John and campus, both the newspaper and with your show, Larry. Of doing the Weather Guy show and answering people's questions, because I'm a real believer. When I came here 36 years ago in the Wisconsin idea of, what we do is to serve the public, both in our research and in our education. So I think that's the thing that really hits me in terms of really enjoying being at UW.
Yeah.
That's nice of you to say, Steve. I feel the same way. This group of three here that are conversing right now have been really central to my experience here. I agree 100%.
Yeah. Steve, makes it fun.
Yeah, well, it's been a lot of fun for me too, and I think I'm sure a lot of fun for our listeners. What are your hopes for the future of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, Steve?
That they hire somebody in remote sensing to replace me. Wisconsin is the birthplace of weather satellites. And for the last couple of years, I've done some research in that area, but not very much. Just done it as part of teams in both Space Science and Engineering Center and the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. So I think with me really stepping down, we really need to look at somebody who carries on that tradition of remote sensing.
Hmm.
Well, the next time you're on, I'll have to call you retired. But in the meantime, you're not. So I'll thank you for being with us, Steve and John. Thank you both so much. We'll look forward to your next visit.
All right, we'll see you then.
All right.
Thanks, Larry.
Yeah, Steve Ackerman and John Martin are weather guys from the UW-Madison Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and Steve will soon be also the former Vice Chancellor of Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. Great to have them back. And they'll be back last Monday of next month. Coming up tomorrow, we'll take a look at tuning up your bike, Bike Maintenance 101 on the show. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.